100 years ago this week, Orville and Wilbur Wright were holed up in a shack on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, doing the final tinkering on their first powered flyer. Across the Atlantic, a 30-year-old Brazilian man sat in his impeccably appointed apartment in Paris, writing an autobiography entitled My Airships. Alberto Santos Dumont was the toast of Europe, called by some the Napoleon of the air. In 1901, he won a major competition when he became the first man to fly around the Eiffel Tower. By 1903, when the Wright brothers were ready to fly, Santos Dumont had accomplished his life's goal. He built a personal flying machine. However, Alberto Santos Dumont had not been experimenting with winged flyers like the Wrights. His ships were dirigibles, but that was about to change. He would take up the challenge of heavier-than-air flight and eventually be dubbed as the man who conquered the air. In the second part of our series on rivals to the Wright brothers, we are joined by Paul Hoffman. He's the author of Wings of Madness, Alberto Santos Dumont and the Invention of Flight. He joins us from member station WAMC in Albany, New York. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So what is it that attracted you to the story of Alberto Santos Dumont?
Well, here was this complete character. This was a guy who preached a kind of aerial spirituality. He built very high tables. They had 10-foot-high legs. And he would have aerial dinner parties in his apartment on the Champs-Élysées in Paris, where he'd invite high society types to dine near his ceiling because they were supposed to experience the same thrill of being in the air that he did. And I was fascinated by the fact that certainly in America, most people I didn't know before I began my research who he was. Yet in 1901, he was about the most famous person in the world, certainly the most famous person in Paris.
What was it that attracted him to flight?
He was a bit of an outcast. He had a large family, and he had many brothers, and they were into lots of things like roughhousing and horseback riding. And Alberto was very bookish, and his brothers and even his father made fun of him for this as a child. And I think he viewed going up in air as a way of escaping your earthly confines, as a way of discovering who you truly were. And he was obsessed from flight by reading about it in fiction. And what turned him to actually working on it when Alberto was 17, his father was thrown from a horse. And Brazilian doctors weren't able to cure him of partial paralysis. So he went to Paris with his son Alberto in tow. And they arrive in Paris, and he's immediately taken by all the technological wonders. I mean, this is in 1891. The Eiffel Tower had just been up for 2 years, and Alberto spent the whole day riding up and down the elevators in it and looking at the bicycles that were everywhere, because in Brazil, there were bicycles, but they only had wooden tires, so you wouldn't go very far because of the friction on the road. Here, people were going everywhere on bikes because they had rubber tires, and the first automobiles were going down the road. He was taken with this, but when he looked at the sky, he saw that, to him, it was astonishingly deficient in flying machines. Where were Verne's creations? So he's made his mind up then that he was going to actually make the first flying machine.
What was he like? I mean, what was his personality like?
He was a great inventor and a great showman. He was a man who was impeccably dressed. He wore opera cloaks. He wore a suit. All the other early aviation pioneers had grease-stained clothes, but he would always manage to slip into a freshly crisp suit just before he went out. He had these Panama hats that he would use to fan out the flames of the engines, because what he did was, he was the first to convert a balloon into a dirigible. And by that I mean, a hot air balloon has no means of powering it, where a dirigible has a motor. What he did was strap a primitive automobile engine onto a balloon and change the shape of the balloon from a sphere to a cigar. And sometimes, because these automobile engines were primitive, I mean, the car had just been invented, there'd be sputtering sparks, which of course was very dangerous when you had a hydrogen-filled balloon. Flames and hydrogen don't mix. Well, when it started sputtering sparks, he would wave his hat to fan out the flames. So the brim of his hat became kind of singed. Well, men all over Paris had to go out, get Panama hats, hold them over their stove flames until the brim collapsed in the same kind of way. People imitated his dress. He set a standard of fashion in Paris, as he set a standard in technology, because he was the only person that was flying above the Paris skyline all the time, experimenting in his dirigible. I mean, he constantly crashed in Paris. I mean, people were amazed that this man went on living. and he always managed to crash in the tonier parts of town, like he landed in the Rothschild's prize chestnut tree, and the Rothschild servants rushed out with ice buckets of champagne to wash away his wounds. That's how he met the Rothschilds, that then funded some of his other balloon trips.
I understand that the bakeries actually would make bread in the shape of...
Yes, you could walk down the Champs-Élysées, and you could buy, first of all, gingerbread cookies in his silhouette, and then you could buy pastries that were shaped like his balloon, and they were colored in the same colors as the Brazilian flag. The president of France complained that they weren't selling cookies in his own silhouette on the Champs-Élysées. So he was a very flamboyant man. He would take off a red tie when he was up there and throw it down to the crowds below. In Toulouse-Lautrec, stumbled over some people trying to get one of these ties. So he was a great aerial showman as much as he was a great inventor.
Describe the day, October 19th, 1901.
Yes, it was an astonishing day. A rich oil baron named Henry Deutsch had put up 100,000 francs, about $20,000, a large amount in 1901, for the first person who could make a basically 14-mile round trip around the top of the Eiffel Tower in half an hour. Well, Alberto, because he was rich, he had inherited a lot of money from his dad, said that when he won the prize, he would give most of it to the poor of Paris. So you had the largest crowd that had ever assembled to date in the world turn out to watch him. And the crowd consisted of at least 12 kings and queens, by my count, lots of rich high society people, and then all the poor of Paris that are out there. You also have Jules Verne and H.G. Wells who are there to see if the flying machines they wrote about would actually come to be in reality. Eiffel, who designed the Eiffel Tower, left himself a small apartment near the tip of it, and Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and Eiffel hung out in this apartment to see whether Santos Dumont would make it. And he made it around the tower, and then he landed like he was supposed to, and everybody was cheering. But the French judges of this prize, who would prefer that a native Frenchman had won instead of a Brazilian, said that he'd overstepped the half an hour time limit by a few seconds. Well, the poor of Paris got very upset, and riots started, and they started marching on the chateaus and mansions of the French judges, and they managed to reverse themselves before their houses were vandalized.
One of his inventions, number 9, you describe as the world's first personal flying machine. What are you talking about that there? What do you mean?
What I mean by that, it was an aerial car. Many people before him and since have dreamed of an aerial car, but he's the only one that had it. He was able to shrink his dirigible so that it was so small, he could keep it parked on the sidewalk in front of his apartment on the Champs-Élysées. It would be tied to a gas lamppost. Every night, he would fly to Maxim's, restaurant that still exists, to dine, and he'd hand a rope, the reins of his balloon, to the doorman, who had strugglingly held it, you know, along with the horses that were tied up. I mean, most people in Paris had never been in a car or owned an automobile at the time that he was flying around in the air. And then not only would he go to Maxim's, he'd fly, you know, to go to shop during the day. I mean, I worked for Michael Eisner at Disney. If he wanted, he could fly a helicopter from his house to the Disney lot, but he couldn't fly to Spago's for dinner or Barney's to shop. I mean, this guy is the only person who's ever had a personal flying machine and used it regularly. And that was the thing that turned me on and why I wanted to research and write this book. And there are pictures of this, and I just loved it.
It gives valet parking a whole new meaning, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Oh, so December 17th, 1903, the Wright brothers achieve the first controlled power flight in a heavier-than-air craft. Did Santos Dumont know what the Wright brothers were doing? Was he aware of what they were doing?
He knew that they were very successful as glider pilots. A lot had been written about their gliding. People didn't know that they were close to building an airplane. And most of the world didn't even know that they had done this after they had done this, because press reports discounted it.
When did Santos Dumont learn of the flight at Kitty Hawk?
He learned after he flew in a heavier-than-air plane. I mean, he flew in 1906, 3 years later. And it's hard to believe he didn't know, but most of the world still didn't know. I mean, he had certainly heard rumors that they had flown, but as soon as he flew in 1906, he was hailed the world over as the person who had conquered the air, not just by the European press, but like by the New York Herald and other New York papers. Even Scientific American was skeptical of the claims of the Wright brothers, and they could hardly be accused of having an American bias. Well, the Wright brothers quickly came out of the woodwork to claim their place in history, and they went to Santos Dumont's backyard in France and flew, you know, many miles, a two-hour flight. So people realized they couldn't have built this plane overnight. It was quite, it was much better than his plane. I mean, his plane was kind of uncontrollable. I mean, he only went about 800 feet in it, and they could now go miles in it. So historians quickly accepted that he flew first.
The last years of Alberto Santos Dumont's life were not very happy ones, especially once the First World War started.
You're right. So as much as he was a showman, he also had a goal in mind in his inventing dirigibles and planes, and that was to bring about world peace. He never patented any of his planes. He wanted everybody to copy them because he believed that if everybody had airplanes and you had some disagreement with somebody in a different country, you could just fly there, work it out. You could see that they're not so different from you and that it would bring the world together. And he had this, I mean, we would say utopian dream now, and it seems almost naive just a few years before World War I to have this dream, but it was very typical of men of science then. I mean, if we look back and you look at all the inventions that changed life so quickly, I mean, the automobile, household electricity, refrigeration, I mean, life expectancy had gone up by 50% in just a few years because of refrigeration and antiseptic measures. So men and women of science believed that science would cure everything. So he had this great vision. And then very quickly in the war, you had the first casualties from the air being caused by balloons, by the German Zeppelins, and balloons were his babies. He could not stand this. And after the war, he really devoted the whole rest of his life to lobbying heads of state, kings and queens. I mean, he visited every country in Europe and everyone in South America, pleading with the heads of state to demilitarize the air, that this wasn't what the pioneers of aviation had in mind. And he basically went mad because of what happened to the airplane.
How did his life end?
His life ended with he returned to his native country in 1932, and there was a civil war in Brazil at the time, and it was the first civil war in the world in which both sides had aircraft. In other words, brothers were killing brothers. And a plane was shot down near a hotel where he was staying. He was having breakfast. And he got up and he asked the elevator operator, who I was able to speak to, who was a 14-year-old kid at the time in 1932 and is still alive today. And he went in the elevator and he told the man to take him back to his room. And he explained to the elevator operator that this wasn't what the pioneers of aviation had in mind. And in these last years of his life, he was very disheveled. He was no longer dressed in a suit, but he changed into one of the suits that he had worn years ago when he was flying over Paris and put on one of the red ties that he would throw down to the crowds from his balloons. And instead, he took the tie and he hung himself from a hook in the bathroom.
I understand that his funeral was delayed because of the war in Brazil, but when he was interred, he did receive a sign of respect from the pilots.
He did. I mean, he was about 6 months after he died, his body could finally be moved from Sao Paulo to Rio, where it was buried, entombed with his parents. And at that moment, on a prearranged signal, as his pallbearers lowered his body into the ground, every plane that was in the air in the world then tipped their wings in a moment of respect.
Paul Hoffman. His book, Wings of Madness, Alberto Santos Dumont and the Invention of Flight, is published by Hyperion. For a picture gallery and more information about Santos Dumont, as well as other rivals to the Wright brothers, go to our website at npr.org.